Hello, I'm Al Randall. This is number 0474, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0474. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back, talking about the mystery of the man-made puncture of the Russian space capsule at the International Space Station.
It's a perfectly round hole. It clearly looks like a drill hole, and it was covered up originally with some gauze-like material that appears to have come off of this panel, exposing this hole. And it looks to me, and what the chatter amongst a lot of people in the space community is saying, is that this was a hole that was accidentally made, most likely, on the ground during the manufacturing process of this orbital module.
Eitan Ilfeld is the inventor of chess diving, which takes the game of chess into the pool.
You're playing chess in a swimming pool. The board is submerged, so it's at the bottom of the pool. And instead of using a chess clock, serious chess players always use a chess clock. Otherwise, if you're in a bad position, you would just basically not move until your opponent gets frustrated. So you have to have some sort of mechanism to keep the pace going. And the mechanism here is very simple. Instead of a chess clock, it's your breath. So basically, you can think for as long as you hold your breath for each move. So you go down, you have to make a move before you come back up, and then your opponent, he or she, has to dive back down, and they have to make a move before they reemerge.
Mindfulness expert Steve Taubman talks about humor and your well-being.
The human body is made better by humor because we know that blood pressure lowers and that the neurohormones are secreted in a different way, and that people live longer, and there are all sorts of wonderful studies on the physical value of humor. Then the mind is made more agile. When you've got a sense of humor, when you've learned how to cultivate your sense of humor, you get to look at situations that play out around you, and instead of your default mode being resistance, your default mode is curiosity and humor.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0474 was Al Randall, former broadcaster and current freelance voice artist, and an all-around nice guy who I worked with many years at the old radio station I used to work at many, many years ago. He's also an avid airplane modeler, and he has some really great models. As a matter of fact, besides being a broadcaster, he's got an array of hobbies that are really fascinating. Thank you very much, Al, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program. Also, a Stuff File shout-out goes to Shell Beckwith in Winnipeg, who became a Patreon patron of the Stuff File program. As everybody knows, as I say each week on the show, the Stuff File program is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. So join us at patreon.com, just like Shell did, and help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, this story is the kind of thing that you hear about on the Stuff File program and probably never hear on your local news program. Actually, you probably would never want to hear this story on your local news program anyway. On September the 3rd, as an unnamed woman drove through Columbia Park, Washington, she witnessed a beaver being struck by a car. She stopped and tried to help the animal, wrapping it in a towel before going home to find a container to put it in. Okay, so far you're probably thinking, aw, this is going to be a warm and fuzzy story with a happy ending. Well, just wait. When she returned to the scene about 30 minutes later, she found 35-year-old Richard Delp sexually assaulting the dying beaver. Unsurprisingly, Delp was also found to be in possession of methamphetamine. Police charged him with possession and animal cruelty. The beaver did not survive. Okay, part of me is deeply concerned while pondering the question, how high do you have to be to want to sexually assault a dying beaver? Part of me also was worried that Richard Delp might not have needed meth to want to sexually assault a dying beaver. And part of me still wonders if Richard Delp has been told stories and he's just confused about not knowing the different meanings, both animal in nature and sexual in nature, when he's been told tales containing the word beaver. Any way you look at it, it's disturbing. Okay, employees at a Walmart store in Wichita Falls, Texas, watched as a man put clothing, food, and electronics in a bag and then left the store without paying for the items. They tried to confront him, but he ran. Walmart called police, knowing the man would be long gone before officers could arrive. But just before officers did arrive, the man came back to the store because he had accidentally left behind something that was important to him. His Bible. He ran out of the store again, but police were able to catch up and arrest 27-year-old Joshua Jeroma Wilhoit on misdemeanor theft charges. Folks, let us all turn to Mark 11:17. And he began to teach and say to them, "It is not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers." The Lord does indeed work in mysterious ways. 25-year-old Christian DeVoe called police and reported a masked man with a rifle had broken into his Tallinn, Connecticut home. While on the phone, dispatchers heard Christian yell, "Hey!" and fire two shots. When officers arrived, they couldn't find any evidence that anyone except Christian had been in his home, and there was no sign of a break-in. They found other inconsistencies in Christian's sworn statement. They said the two shots were warning shots he fired over the intruder's head, but the bullet holes were less than 3 feet off the floor. When confronted, Christian allegedly told the officers, "There are some things he just can't explain, like seeing ghosts." He explained that he has been a paranormal investigator for 5 to 6 years and said that he used the intruder story because he didn't want police to think he was insane. He was charged with illegal discharge of a firearm, making a false statement to police, second-degree reckless endangerment, misusing an emergency call, and disorderly conduct. Okay, but on the off chance that he might have been telling the truth, and he was firing a warning shot over their heads, then it would appear that we're looking for a really, really, really short ghost. On the other hand, if he's been a paranormal investigator for 5 or 6 years, what did he think shooting simple bullets at a ghost was going to do? Spook it? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have another story here that's sorta, kinda related to the last one. Sorta, kinda. I'm gonna need some music for this one, okay? Thank you. A Berks County, Pennsylvania man who admitted he drunkenly fired a shotgun inside his apartment because he feared there were clowns inside could spend the next 5 years in prison. Reading police didn't find anyone inside 35-year-old Nathaniel Matthias's second-floor apartment and say the shooting put his first-floor neighbor in danger. Matthias was sentenced last week to 22 months to 5 years in state prison after pleading guilty in July to discharging a firearm and to an unrelated drunk driving charge. Police say they found Matthias clutching a shotgun outside his home, claiming he was trying to shoot two small clowns. Matthias's attorney says his client wasn't trying to harm anyone but was reacting to some type of hallucinatory event. Matthias took full responsibility and apologized. Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Well, maybe next year. Wow. We're shooting at ghosts and clowns this week. This is turning into a bad episode of Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Dooby-Doo!
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Science writer Andrew Vazekas, the Night Sky Guy, is back on the show with a real-life mystery in space. Or should I say, a whodunit. a hole that caused an air leak and pressure to drop at the International Space Station at the end of August was caused by a man-made drill hole, not a micrometeorite strike. And some are saying that it may even have been punctured deliberately as an act of sabotage. Well, anyway, by the way, Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. He joins us on the line via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
So many people are talking about this, and there are so many theories out there, but we spoke before off air, and you had an interesting theory that I hadn't heard yet, and I kind of like yours. What is your theory behind this mystery puncture in space?
Well, this hole is part of the orbital module of the Soyuz spacecraft that's used to ferry astronauts to and from the space station. And this particular spacecraft has been docked to the space station for now a number of weeks, actually almost on the order of a couple of months. And this hole is located in that orbital module. So it's not a part of the de facto space station modules that stay within space, but the one that actually attaches to it and comes up from the Earth in this taxi service to and from orbit. And this small tiny hole appears to have been made from the inside, not from the outside, but from the inside. And if the close-up images show that it's a perfectly round hole, it clearly looks like a drill hole, and it was covered up originally with some other material, some gauze-like material that appears to have come off of this panel, exposing this hole. And it looks to me, and what the chatter amongst a lot of people in the space community is saying, is that this was a hole that was accidentally made, most likely, on the ground during the manufacturing process of this orbital module. And you can see, if you look very closely at the images, they show next to the hole, it looks like scuff marks, a series of identical scuff marks leading to the hole that looks very much as if a drill bit sort of skipped along the surface of the panel until it actually made the hole. So the theory is right now, the leading theory I think that I like and a lot of other space analysts like, is that this was a manufacturing error done somewhere in the shops in Russia when they were manufacturing this orbital module. And then this technician may have inadvertently created this hole and then covered it up with material, like maybe perhaps some kind of gum-like glue, perhaps, that was stuffed into the hole. And then when they would actually test the module for its ability to withstand the extreme environments of the zero or microgravity vacuum, basically vacuum testing it, because the hole was plugged, there it would have passed the test. And it would have, been sent off to the launch pad, which it obviously did. So that's right now the leading theory. Something happened on the ground, not necessarily in space where this hole was made.
So this must be even more terrifying for the technician, he or her, who is involved in this, because if your theory is correct, they know what they did. And let's be honest, this is the space, this is the bread and butter nowadays, the pride and joy of the Russians, and we are talking about Russian justice. These people, this person must be terrified.
Yes, I mean, and there was a statement released this week by Roscosmos, which is the Russian space agency, that they are considering all theories. They've convened a state commission to investigate what caused this hole, and the administrator of the Russian space agency said that it's really a matter of honor for the space agency to discover what this, how this happened, to figure out how the hole was made. Was it a defect? Was it made on purpose? And, you know, and they say, quote, I'm quoting here, "Now it is essential to see the reason, to learn the name of the one responsible for that, and we will find out without fail."
Okay,
this
so
is from, for the official statement.
You mentioned the official statement, and they said something. Is it a defect? Is it deliberate? From the way you were describing it, I tend to agree with you, and that really it's neither. It's not a defect, nor was it deliberate. It was just an accident that someone was trying to cover up.
That's what I think. I think somebody went, oops, and they knew that they would get in trouble, and they tried to do a quick patch-up work, hoping that it would never be discovered. But of course, being in space for a number of months, it's very likely that that this whatever was plugging the hole got loose, detached, and then this leak started happening. And it was detected probably within, you know, within hours of it occurring. NASA was able to detect the lowering of the pressure, the air pressure inside the modules, very slightly. But it wasn't a, it wasn't any urgency. What's interesting is that on August 29th, it was found late in the evening, and NASA noticed it, but they decided not to notify the crew, let them sleep that night, and then notify them the next day, because they noticed that it wasn't of any urgency. And in fact, they did the calculations that if this leak was just let loose by itself to continue on, it would have taken 14 days, a full 2 weeks, for all the air pressure to leave the space station. So it was it wasn't really an immediate crisis or emergency, but this does make you think. What is the manufacturing process like in Russia right now, with all the budget cuts and stuff, of what's going on in terms of the safety of their manufacturing process?
Well, it makes me think of something else entirely as well. And as I think, to be clear, we have to specify, because so many of us here in North America were familiar with the shuttle program. And the thing about the shuttle program was those flights were of a reusable nature. A Soyuz capsule goes up, it goes down, it is not used again, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So having said that, two things. One, is there any concern, because one of the things you said that report stated was, is it a defect? Which again, both you and I have agreed, we don't think it is, but let's go on that assumption. Is it a problem with other Soyuz capsules? And something that I haven't heard anybody talk about, if they've managed to plug this and correct the problem, how permanent is the correction? Meaning, is there a problem with this Soyuz capsule upon reentry?
And that's interesting that you bring that up. That was some journalists had have already asked that very directly of both NASA and Roscosmos. And they say, no, this it will not affect the reentry of the spacecraft. The repair job is quite permanent of what they've done, but it does bring into play of, you know, the was this a mistake? You know, could this, and I believe that this was a mistake. It's not something that may be inherent in the quality control necessarily, but it just does raise an eyebrow, at least, of what could be going on there. And I would not want to be this technician on the ground who may have made this mistake and realized it and tried to do a patch-up job or something. It doesn't bode well.
Yeah, somebody's going to be looking for a political asylum. And having said that, let's bring up politics. Politics always rears its ugly head in everything. Does this situation, regardless of what the cause is or what's involved, the fact that it happened, is it doing anything at all to speed up or change the trajectory of the American plan to get back into space with a reusable rocket that they can shuttle their own astronauts or other astronauts back and forth to the space station and not depend on the Soviets or the Russians?
Well,
I should say.
Yeah, I think this whole incident will probably spur on discussion, especially, I think, in the political halls of Congress there. In the U.S. and Washington, that, you know, we really need to speed up the process of getting American astronauts on American rockets going back into space. And, you know, Boeing is working on it very clearly. So is SpaceX. And we're looking at launches probably late in next year, 2019. They should be ready, these two different spacecrafts, private spacecrafts that will be taking U.S. astronauts back into space. I think definitely this makes the case that it's important to have multiple sources, multiple vehicles from different parts of the world that will be offer this taxi service to and from low Earth orbit.
Andrew, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I know you're very busy. You're busy writing your second book.
That's right. That's right. Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, coming out by from National Geographic next year, end of March 2019. So folks should stay tuned. That's a great beginner's guide to the night sky. So if you don't know anything about how to navigate the heavens, this is the book for you.
Looking forward to it, and I'm sure we'll talk about it on this program when it does come out. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir. Thanks for being with us once again.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy and author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0474, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about chest diving. Plus, we'll talk to a mindfulness expert about how humor is a very important part of your life. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a program that is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. Well, after an investigation of a road rage incident, the California Highway Patrol pieced together what happened. The two men's cars hit each other on Interstate 5 in Sacramento, and they pulled over to fight. Witnesses say 37-year-old Jose Rodriguez Carrasco chased after 39-year-old Jason Dykes with a baseball bat. Before officers could get there, Rodriguez Carrasco had killed Dykes, but he won't be arrested. Before officers could get there, Rodriguez Carrasco, who was apparently walking on the freeway, was hit by a car and killed. Dykes had his driver's license suspended 10 years ago and apparently couldn't get it back because he kept being cited for driving with a suspended license, as well as other infractions such as speeding. Meanwhile, Rodriguez Carrasco had applied for a driver's license but hadn't completed the process. Wow. Death. The maximum sentence for road rage. You know, this is a story that has found a karmic way of removing two bad drivers from the road. Monica Wally of Holden Heights, Florida, wrote a negative online review on August the 20th about the Daybreak Diner in Orlando, accusing the restaurant of refusing service to her disabled mother. The negative review didn't sit well with the diner's owner's son, Michael Johnson, or his housemates, Jesse Martin and Norman Auville. That evening, as the three sat drinking beer, Martin looked up Wally's address. Then they drove to her home, where the 42-year-old Auville shot three rounds into the house. "I actually could feel the air from the bullet as it passed by me," said Ken Wally, who was Monica's father. "I didn't think anybody was crazy enough to do something like this over something so small," Monica Wally said. Auville was arrested August 30th and charged with shooting into a dwelling. What, the other two guys weren't charged with anything? Anyway, this is a story that should be cause for concern and a word of caution for anybody who regularly posts stuff on Yelp.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
At 4:30 a.m., a Monroe County, Florida sheriff's deputy saw a pickup truck leaving a fast food restaurant at a high rate of speed. He attempted a traffic stop, but the driver led a high-speed chase. The man crashed into the Duck Key Island sign, but that wasn't the end of the chase. He crawled out of his truck, ran toward a seawall, and jumped into the water, where he continued to swim away south towards Tom's Harbor Channel, according to the pursuing deputy. After a half-hour search, officers aboard a Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission boat located 31-year-old Nicholas Trauka and pulled him out of the water. He refused a field sobriety test, saying, "I'm already going to jail, so why?" Still, a breath test revealed Trauka's blood alcohol level was at 0.214%. He was arrested and charged with a long list of offenses. Talk about an Ironman triathlon, huh? His next triathlon, by the way, will involve pacing in his cell, working out in the exercise yard, and running away from gangs. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, when 51-year-old Roy Meadwell of Yeovil, Somerset, England, was dumped by his fiance 2 years ago, he reacted badly. He was convicted of assaulting her, and the court issued a restraining order to keep him from contacting her or even setting foot in the county where she lives. But Meadwell was arrested after scheming to get Kay Wimbury to come back to him. Using knowledge of her family, Meadwell sent Wimbury a message via a tarot shop in her town pretending to be her dead mother. It was a message from beyond the grave imploring her to take Meadwell back, the prosecutor said. Wimbury wasn't fooled and called police. Now, last year, Meadwell was convicted in a similar case with his next girlfriend. He denied breaking the Wimbury restraining order, but a jury found him guilty on 4 counts after only 38 minutes of deliberation. He was sentenced to 4 months in jail, suspended for 2 years, and the restraining order was reaffirmed. His solicitor assured the court that Meadwell was taking a Building Better Relationships class to keep him from reoffending. Well, you know, building relationships isn't his problem. It's the demolition part that he has trouble with. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Have you ever thought of playing chess underwater? That is a thing, you know. It's called diving chess, and there are even world championships. Eitan Ilfeld is the inventor of diving chess, and he joins us on the line via Skype from London, England. Hi, Eitan.
Hey, Peter. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So I was looking around for news items, and I came across the story of the championships and a video of it, and I said, oh, no, we have to find out more about this. So since you are the inventor, the creator of diving chess, I have to ask you right off the bat, how did this come about?
Sure. Yeah, it's a bit of a wacky thing, and it's a lot of fun. First, let me ask you, where did you see it, or how did you hear about it? Because we had this year, we've been running the Diving Chess World Championships for several years now, and we had a Reuters journalist, and I got reports that people saw it all over the world, in the Philippines, in Australia, you know, in the States and Canada, really just all over. So I'm wondering, yeah, how did you see it?
Well,
on local news or the internet or what?
I think you just answered the question. I go through many news services through the course of the week looking for interesting stories, and this one came up. So it might have been the Reuters report that you you mentioned, and also it came with an accompanying video. So I've seen what it looks like. But I want to know, because, you know, when you see the word chest diving, you get an idea that it's from a high height, and that's just not the case. So explain what chest diving is.
So basically, you're playing chess in a swimming pool. The board is submerged, so it's at the bottom of the pool. And instead of using a chess clock, serious chess players always use a chess clock. Otherwise, if you're in a bad position, you would just basically not move until your opponent gets frustrated. So you have to have some sort of mechanism to keep the pace going. And the mechanism here is very simple. Instead of a chess clock, it's your breath. So basically, you can think for as long as you hold your breath for each move. So you go down, you have to make a move before you come back up above water, and then your opponent, he or she, has to dive back down, and they have to make a move before they reemerge, and so on and so on. As soon as they come up, you go down, you have to make a move, and it just goes on until someone wins. And it's normal chess. You're still playing chess. But you're basically using your breath, and it's quite physically challenging.
Now, do you have to use any kind of special board? I would assume the pieces had to be a little bit weighted down so they don't kind of float away.
Oh, yeah. So over the years, I've improved the customized boards that we use, where the pieces are weighted, and we've got very strong magnets on the pieces. So there's no way that the piece will, I don't know, fall over because someone's kicking around and splashing in the pool. I mean, these pieces are very, very sturdy.
Now, it's one thing to create a game, to create something like this, but it's another thing to get people to agree to it. So when you first came up with the idea of this, how did you bring it to others, and how did you get, and how on board were they?
So let me go back a bit to the origin of the game. I've always loved playing chess. I love chess. It's a great game, and there's so many great tempos to play, different variations as well. It's an amazing game, and I'm a USCF chess master, and I've been living in London now for 11 years. Back in 2008, I went to this board game tournament called the Mind Sports Olympiad, where you compete in lots of different games. I went there to play chess, but they had people competing in Scrabble and lots of other new cool games. What was interesting was I found out about all these different games, and I basically wanted to learn and try different things. So I came back the following year and played again, and I tried lots of other games. And then there's this really bizarre tournament called the Creative Thinking World Championship. And that's a very strange thing, where basically you have to come up with a lot of crazy ideas, and you have all these open-ended questions. And it's I guess most of the things are objectively marked, but some are a little bit subjective. And it was in that competition that I came up with the idea of diving chess. Well, I thought, wow, how could I combine two things and make chess more challenging? Also, going back to chess, you know, everybody agrees that it's an extremely cerebral thing. There's no doubt about that. So some people say that maybe it's a bit of a science, but also it's a bit of an art as well. There's a lot of creativity and beauty in the game as well. Chess has a lot of depth. But some people have tried to make the argument that perhaps chess is a sport. And this can be quite controversial. You know, obviously, being in good shape will mean that you'll probably do better in a multi-day tournament. And if you play in a chess tournament, you get used to playing very long games. So you might be playing two games a day, 5 hours each. You might be 10 hours of playing. So being in good shape is important. There's no doubt about that. But is it a sport? I don't know. I'm not sure the chess itself, regular tournament chess, is a sport. But I thought, what can I do to create a version of it that definitely is a sport? How can I make it physically demanding and play with the idea of time? And that's basically how I came up with diving chess. And I started off as a volunteer after falling in love with this idea of the Mind Sports Olympiad, where you play lots of games. And so I volunteered to organize some of the future tournaments. And since then, I've been running the annual Mind Sports Olympiad. Like I said, it's this amazing board game tournament and festival in London. And by running it, I also had a platform to introduce diving chess to a lot of crazy game players, basically, who are open to trying something new. And so the first Diving Chess World Championship, I think, was in 2013, something like that. And people just thought it was a lot of fun. It's really built up since. And it's very quirky. I mean, it's not that interesting to watch people play chess, but when you see people playing chess in a swimming pool, that's actually visually stimulating.
It's a little difficult, though, for it to be a spectator sport unless everything has a camera underwater and it's also shown on a video somewhere. So clearly, when you first started this, because of the location that you were doing it at, you had a built-in audience. How did you get it to build and grow beyond what is essentially a quirky bunch of guys and gals who are really up for anything?
Right, absolutely. Well, I think it was really getting some good video. So I took some GoPro cameras and got some cool videos, and people were just extremely entertained by these videos, much as you were, I guess. They started contacting me, and it already had a good amount of press over the last few years and in a lot of places. Sometimes I'm even surprised to hear where people have seen it. And I've had people reach out to me also asking to buy custom-made diving chess boards, which I've even sold a few, but I haven't really tried to build much on that. But it's just been cool to learn and grow this board. And there's also been a lot in terms of the competition. I mean, it's gotten stronger and stronger over the years. We keep having newcomers, but what's interesting, we're still forming some of the rules. So there's a little bit of a debate at the moment as to whether or not you should be able to use a wetsuit, because actually it gets really cold when you're in a swimming pool for several hours. Our world championship takes about 4.5 hours, and you're spending, I guess, 80% of that time in the pool. Between rounds, people, they go and take a hot shower, they go to the sauna, you really got to warm up, or you swim laps, because when you're just diving into a pool up and down and then standing and then thinking, making a move, there's not enough blood flow. So it can get quite cold. If you're in a warm pool, obviously, I guess London's pretty chilly, but in a warmer climate or a very heated pool, that wouldn't be as much of an issue. But physically, that's already one challenging question. And then also, if you see some of our videos, you'll notice that it's actually not that easy to dive to the bottom of the swimming pool and stay down. You usually need to exhale in order to sink. So people work on different types of techniques to be able to do that. Some people use weights, and that's also been an interesting thing, which we're figuring out. Is it, should weights be banned or not? Because a weight will help you sink and do that. These are all really tough and interesting questions, and we're still figuring out. At the moment, we let people bring equipment to and choose the type of goggles they want to use. But obviously, you can't use any scuba gear or anything like that. You've got to, you still have to hold your breath at the end of the day.
How big do you think this can get? How big would you like it to get?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I just want people to have fun, right? How big can it get? I don't know. Anything's possible. I mean, there are a lot of swimming pools in the world and a lot of people who like chess. So I guess the sky's the limit. It's not something that I'm working too actively to promote. I just really enjoy running the world championship every year. And if people want to know more about it and reach out to me, I'm happy to try and help out. But
be honest, in your deepest, darkest dreams, would you like to see in a world, would you like to see a world where somebody will say, chess on land is so passe?
That would be very entertaining. First of all, I don't think that will ever be completely true, because obviously there's different types of chess, and I love traditional chess as well. But sure, of course, it would be entertaining. And if it ever became an Olympic sport one day, that would boggle my mind for sure. That would be amazing. But yeah, I mean, right now we're just really just having fun with it and trying to improve the standards of it. But yeah, I think that if people want to try it and they want something that's challenging and different, it's definitely a very cool version of chess. I mean, at the Mind Sports Olympiad, which this is one of the events, so we have lots of different chess variants. For people who aren't used to who are still, don't play normal chess, they may not know that there are crazy variations. In the States, there's one called Bug House, which we call exchange chess, where you play on two boards and you can take pieces and transfer them to the other board. There's lots of cool chess variants, and there's lots of great games in the world.
So if people want more information, they can go to the website, which is msoworld.com, correct?
Absolutely, yeah, msoworld.com. And you can learn a lot more about the Mind Sports Olympiad that takes place every year in London. We've got crazy games from diving chess to wacky events like speed reading, where we had someone read a 400-page book this year in 64 minutes. Yeah, there's lots of cool things happening, and I want people to try new games and challenge themselves. That's what it's all about.
I know we've been talking about diving chess, or chess diving, but will you come back on the program and talk a little bit more on another point about some of the other games that you are talking about with the MSO World?
Oh, I would absolutely love to do that. We've got over 80 different games and over a dozen world championships, so there's a lot of interesting stories there.
So we'll have you back on. I thank you for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Eitan Ilfeld, the inventor of diving chess. You can find out more about it and the other games he was talking about by going to msoworld.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0474, and you'll find links to their site and also links to Eitan's. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. People who have heard about our annual Wacky Warning Labels contest often ask us if there are certain kinds of labels we don't accept for our contest, even if they are funny. That's a really good question, and the answer is yes. There are many hilarious warnings that aren't necessarily common sense, so they're needed for consumer safety reasons. I'd like to tell you about one funny label we haven't used, and why. The warning comes on packaging for a pain reliever called PMS Mitol. Obviously, it's for women, but it warns, do not use if you have an enlarged prostate. Now, let's be fair, you don't need to be a doctor to know that someone with PMS is not going to have a prostate. Kids, trust me. But the side effects of this medicine are not common knowledge, and there may be a man somewhere with a headache so bad he's willing to use PMS Mitol, so that warning needs to be there. If you have a funny, common sense warning that would be good for our contest, send it to us. Find out how you could be the next $1,000 grand prize winner at centerforamericatv.org.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about humor and your well-being with a mindfulness expert. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And another Stuff File news story I want to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Florida man was arrested for shooting at his boss 2 hours after he was fired and just 3 days after he was hired. The employer, Sean Jackson, was unharmed. 22-year-old DeJuan Lewis faces charges of attempted felony murder and shooting from and into a moving motor vehicle. Lewis began working at Bonita Aluminum Products on Thursday. Jackson told authorities he fired Lewis 5 a.m. Sunday. Jackson began driving home with his girlfriend, Lakeisha Klug, at 7 a.m. when they noticed a vehicle was following them. The driver of the vehicle fired 5 shots, causing damage to the rear bumper, trunk, and rear right tire. Jackson and Klug drove back to the parking lot of Aluminum Products, where they called the police. Another witness and employee of Aluminum Products told authorities that he saw Lewis lingering outside after his termination in a car with a handgun. Seminole County Sheriff's Deputy Eric Aragon Vela arrived at the location where he was advised Lewis was parked in a driveway. Lewis told the deputy about the gun and also a knife in his possession. He then admitted to the shooting and was transported to John E. Polk Correctional Facility. So, let me get this straight. You get hired on Thursday, fired on Sunday, and you try to kill your ex-boss 2 hours later. This will not look good on a resume. Oh, and you can forget about getting a recommendation. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our third guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Steve Taubman is a hypnotist, author, entertainer, and motivational speaker. He's also a mindfulness expert, and in his job, he believes that one of the most important tools he can use is humor. So let's talk about that. Steve is also the author of Buddha in the Trenches, the timeless system for developing unshakable performance under pressure. He joins us via Skype right now from Vermont. Hi, Steve.
Well, hi, how are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us.
What a pleasure.
So I said in the introduction that you're a mindfulness expert. How does one become a mindfulness expert, and what exactly is that?
Well, it's the easiest expertise to gain because it's being an expert at nothing.
Okay.
So, you know, we all fill our heads day in and day out with all sorts of useless and sometimes useful information. But what we don't do very well is find the off switch. We don't know how to quiet our minds. Right. And so what it is to be an expert in mindfulness is learning the tools and techniques to quiet the mind, to kind of find that underneath all of that constant dialogue, inner dialogue, there is a quiet place, and there's a lot of value to visiting that place.
So it's almost like getting out of your own head kind of thing.
It's exactly that. In fact, one of the tools we teach people, or one of the ways we describe one of the meditative practices, is we say, get out of your head and into your body.
Now, as I said, humor is a big part of this. So tell us a little bit about how humor plays a role and what humor actually does to the human spirit, I guess is what I'm asking here, and the human mind.
And the human body,
so, yes.
Yeah, so, well, let's start there. The human body is made better by humor because we know that blood pressure lowers and that the neurohormones are secreted in a different way and that people live longer, and there are all sorts of wonderful studies on the physical value of humor. Then the mind is made more agile. When you've got a sense of humor, when you've learned how to cultivate your sense of humor, you get to look at situations that play out around you, and instead of your default mode being resistance, your default mode is curiosity and humor. You know, you start looking at things in a different way, and of course, there's lots of things to be miserable about, but it's the intelligent, the wise, the person with a willingness to look a little bit deeper who has to find the humor. That's why we pay great comedians lots and lots of money, because they were able to look at the same thing we looked at in misery and come out on the other side with something funny.
So do you spend a lot of time whistling Monty Python's Always Look at the Bright Side of Life?
No, I've got a song like it. My friend wrote a song. It's called I'm Gonna Die with a Smile If It Kills Me.
Oh, I love that.
That's my new mantra. I say, you know, like I've got this thing going right now, Peter, where I say, you know, that it's game theory. You know, everything in life is like a game if you think of it that way. You know, whether it's a serious game like, you know, you're trying to get bin Laden or, you know, trying to put up with the American political system right now, or it's an actual game like football or whatever, or, you know, maybe you're trying to lose weight. But if you think of it as a game, every game has a goal. And that's, you know, where you could set humor as your goal or happiness as your goal, and then has a process or a practice to get there. You know, if you run toward the goal line, you're more likely to get there than if you run away from it.
Okay, so now all the things you're talking about and what you do for a living, let's be honest, that, you know, you're not far from where I am geographically. You're in Vermont. I travel to Vermont semi-regularly because you're a neighbor to us, and they're the happiest, friendliest people I've ever come across. So it's not difficult. It's not difficult to be who you are in Vermont.
Well, I grew up on Long Island, and I've got family on Long Island, so I know the drill. And you know, when I teach people about mindfulness and meditation and other tools, I say to them that, you know, if you learn these simple tools, they'll do a number of things for you. Among which is they'll help you survive your next family gathering.
So besides Bernie Sanders, how does someone from New York end up in Vermont?
Well, same with Ben and Jerry,
yes.
Right, yeah. It's because smart New Yorkers know that there's something really special about Vermont. We, you know, New Yorkers, you know, we're kind of quick and we're motivated. But those of us who, you know, also place a value on happiness and inner peace, you know, we look for places where we're not going to be in a constant state of turmoil. And Vermont's one of those places.
Okay, so in all seriousness to what I said earlier, is it more difficult to espouse the theories that you're talking about in a place that's more of a rat race like a New York or any other major metropolitan center?
Well, temporarily, I'd say yes. In other words, if you're currently miserable and you're trying to be not miserable and you're trying to live your life with humor and grace, and you're starting out in New York, yeah, maybe, because it's kind of hard to get quiet in a noisy place at the beginning. But these are learnable skills, learnable tools. And when you start learning these skills and these tools, I could sit down and meditate in Grand Central Station I could close my eyes and shut everything else out and be peaceful, because I believe that we're all capable of having inner peace even if there's outer noise.
And so what you're saying is it does come from within, because if you're miserable in New York and you decide, oh, I like what I hear Steve talking about, I'm going to move to Vermont because he sounds like a happy person, you're going to be miserable in Vermont too, right?
Well, you'll probably, unless you meet me.
Unless you meet you, yes.
Yeah, definitely. So we take our inner selves with us pretty much wherever we go. Like Jackson Brown said, no matter how fast I run, I can never seem to get away from me.
Mm.
So it ultimately comes down to doing some kind of inner work, you know, making the commitment to it, realizing it's important, knowing that there's a path, and then following that path.
Now, I also said in the introduction that you are a hypnotist. Again, how does one know that they can be hypnotized or be a hypnotist?
Well, which of those questions do you want me to take first? Okay, let's go with how does one know if they can be hypnotized? We know that we're all, in every one of us, in essence, going in and out of hypnosis every day, all day long. In fact, it's estimated we spend about 40 to 70% of our day in a trance. That's why you drive past your exit or you get home, you don't remember how you got there. We're constantly going into state, what we call going into state, meaning we're going into trance. And so we live our lives on automatic, which means we're kind of hypnotized, we're kind of half awake, and we're less effective than we could be. So being a hypnotist, knowing that most of us are hypnotized anyway is a good leg up. We already know that it's a state we're familiar with.
Now, I mentioned your book also, Buddha in the Trenches, The Timeless System for Developing Unshakable Performance Under Pressure. Tell us a little bit about this book and why you wrote it and who you wrote it for.
Well, I wrote Buddha in the Trenches after having written my first book on hypnosis. Unhypnosis was really for entrepreneurs and people trying to figure out what they wanted to do with their lives. And then Buddha in the Trenches came along as a book for people who are already sort of in a particular position in their lives. They're not looking to get out of it. They have a job. They may not like their job. It may be a stressful job. They're not looking to change that, but they'd like to be less stressed out. They'd like to be more calm, more peaceful, have more resourcefulness, more creativity. And so this is a book about the psychology of getting out of the triggers, the patterns that get you stuck, so that you can be in a very stressful situation without you yourself being very stressed out.
Do you find that sometimes people just do things by rote? And I'm not talking about doing their job, but even just getting into a job. Like, some people just don't know why they're doing what they're doing, even if they're doing it every day.
Oh, yeah. This is why, you know, one of my favorite quotes is, know thyself, right? That's what Socrates said, know thyself, because we usually don't. We're usually, as you said, we're on automatic. Whatever we're doing for a living, not only, as you said, are we a little bit unconscious doing it, but we're a little bit unconscious about how we got there in the first place, because there are so many cultural cues that tell us this is what you need to do when you grow up. This is what you need to be. This is the kind of car you need to drive. This is the kind of clothes you need to wear. And so we become a little bit entrapped by this without necessarily stopping and noticing and realizing it. And then one day we wake up and, like that Talking Head song, this is not my beautiful wife. This is not my beautiful car. It's like, how did I get here?
It sounds like your book is something that someone needs to suggest to someone else. And the reason why I say that is someone who really needs your book is so on that track, like you were discussing earlier, that they're not aware of the rut that they may be in.
Oh, I'm famous for creating products that are exactly that fit that description. So I have a program. It's one of my favorite programs I've ever created, and it's called Procrastination Annihilation. and it teaches people how not to procrastinate. But of course, the people who really need it never get around to buying it.
Well, we'll try to get them off the couch, as its saying goes, and get them to your book. The book is called Buddha in the Trenches, The Timeless System for Developing Unshakable Performance Under Pressure. It's written by Steve Taubman, who is in idyllic Burlington, Vermont. Steve, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Absolute pleasure being here. Thanks so much for having me.
Mindfulness expert Steve Taubman. His book is Buddha in the Trenches, The Timeless System for Developing Unshakable Performance Under Pressure. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0474, and you'll find links to Steve's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A Riverhead, New York man was indicted on charges that he burglarized 10 residences in 2017 and 2018. 23-year-old Tahim Mackay was charged with 10 counts of burglary in the second degree. The Suffolk County Department of Probation traced Mackay to the burglary locations through a GPS ankle monitor. Authorities did not say why Mackay was on probation. According to a police statement, this indictment is a result of excellent investigative work by detectives in the Riverhead Police Department who used technology and the sharing of intelligence to find the alleged perpetrator responsible for these burglaries. What? They just used Google search? These are brazen acts committed in broad daylight by an individual who clearly has no respect for the law. Mackay allegedly stole cash, jewelry, designer sneakers, designer belts, and a wallet from the residences. If convicted, he faces a maximum sentence of 5 to 15 years in prison on each count of the indictment, which could run consecutively. Now, why? Oh, why would you commit a string of burglaries when you're wearing a GPS ankle monitor? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0474. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0474. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?